Okay, welcome everyone to this visiting lecture by Dennis Davido from Hanken School of Business. At the moment, he has been working in Vaasa for many years, but he's now in Hanken. He's a kind of a regular visitor to this course. I have changed many other visitors, but not Dennis, because his message is such an important message, because he will be discussing about digital banking. You took a look at the decentralized finance things already last week, but Dennis is now deepening that knowledge quite a lot. So before I let him take the stage, I would like to remind you about the visit to OP and Nordea right after the course. Please sign up for that visit, because I have to know the exact names for the participants, for the banks, because they have to write the cards for your visit there. So that's in Moodle. So sign up there and let me know whether you want to use the bus or not. But otherwise, these are the practical things. I'm very happy to see you here once again. And please go on.
Thank you. Very kind introduction once again. Not sure if it's a good thing or a bad thing that you did change.
It's definitely good.
But anyways, thanks. Okay, so I'm sorry in advance for the distant participants, because the camera here is a tiny small camera on top of the screen. So, and I tend to move quite a bit during the lecture. So it might be so that I will be disappearing from the screen sometime, but anyways, pay attention to the slides. That's the most important, not my face. The slides are the most important part. Okay. And appreciate those who came today. Very nice seeing you. I'm going to be talking about digital banking. It's not a surprise for you. I think somewhere in your slides or somewhere in the introduction to the course, there were something about the new forms of banking, right? So it was written. My part of the lectures were kind of described as some sort of the new forms of banking. And I mean, we can talk about forms for a long time, but essentially it's not really obvious whether it's the new form or it's just a new way of doing certain things, right? So that's why I just cut off the word forms from the title and left it as the new banking. I like it better this way. So new banking is cool. A little bit about myself. So I'm Dennis. I, just like you, I've been doing my master's degree in Finland. So it wasn't the Jyväskylä, but it was at the University of Vaasa. And that was, I got my master's, if I remember correctly, it was 2008 or 9. So anyways, long time ago. And then I continued at the PhD, so I got excited about finance. It was master's degree program in finance, so it wasn't really banking related, it was finance in general. So I got really interested in finance, and then I continued as the PhD, and then I got my PhD in 2014. So that's already 8 years ago, more than 8 years ago. So I graduated with the doctoral degree, and my topic was about the empirical banking. Surprise, surprise. It was with corporate finance / empirical banking. Okay. And after that, I stayed at the University of Oslo for some time. But nowadays, as you can probably see from the slides, I'm employed by Hanken School of Economics as the assistant professor in finance. Okay. So before that, I used to work in the industry for a little bit. I used to work actually for a commercial bank. But at the time when I was working, we had no idea that the field would take this form. I'm using the word form, but in this occasion, it's fine again. So we had no idea that at some stage we'll be talking about substitution effect of the software to people. Or other way around, actually, people to software, right? So, but even then, I think the year when I was employed at the bank was somewhere around 2005, 2006. And even at that time, we already were trying to, you know, we had a small, I was employed actually at the for loans to companies. And those were usually large loans starting from 100,000 euros, let's put it this way. So even at that time, we had a nice small department where we were trying to innovate a little bit, because every time when you were giving out the loan, you actually had to write a multi-page expert opinion about the loan and about its performance, future performance, and whether the loan, the idea of this opinion was basically to provide some sort of an expert opinion whether the loan would be a successful venture for the bank or not. Okay, so that was the idea. And even at that time, because, you know, it was kind of a static work, of course different loans require different inputs, but in the sense the format of the of this report and the words that you're using in this report were pretty much the same. So we were bored, and we were trying to innovate a little bit. So we were trying to automate the writings of this multi-page report. It was fun to do the analysis. It was fun to go to the companies and see the business and try to evaluate the business and try to evaluate the impact of the loan for the business. It was a lot of fun, very, very kind of interesting job. But then writing this down in the form of the report was not that fun. So we were trying to innovate and trying to automate the writing of the report. So we had an Excel program. So in the very basic format of programming and the Visual Basic, we were trying to automate the writings of this report. So if, for instance, some analysis shows that the report was getting this or that ratios from some of the financial analysis, then it would take these particular phrases and words and put them in the report automatically. So all you have to do is just to run the financial analysis part. Once it's ready, you just plug in the numbers and you end up with the text. So that was kind of a little bit of innovation. Of course, it's not the case anymore. I mean, the banking field has made a huge step forward. And nowadays it's probably gonna be not really enough if you just do a similar Visual Basic programming and try to automate the text writing. We'll get back to that a little bit later. We'll see what we're dealing with. So this is gonna be a 2 days lecture. So today and tomorrow we have roughly 6 hours, academic hours. So, there's plenty of material. I'll try to go into details and some, and then the rest I will try to you know, just to, for your information, to provide some additional stuff. But if you have any questions during the lecture, please don't feel ashamed to stop me and interrupt at any moment. Okay. So new banking. New banking is related to digital banking, right? Obviously. So I didn't put the word forms, as I said, because I'm not sure if it's the new form of doing the same business, or whether it's just a business which is, you know, adjusting to the new type of people who you are, basically, right? So everything is online, everything is on cloud, everything is mobile. So that's why, like, familiar sort of services to us adjust, right? So that's why I'm not sure if it's a new form, but at least it's something new. Let's see, what's new? What's really new? So there is a paper by these guys over here. It was published in the Review of Financial Studies, which is a top finance journal. It's called On the Rise of Fintechs, Credit Scoring Using Digital Footprint. Okay, it's very interesting because this is the direct quote from the paper. So they say that even simple, easily accessible variables from the digital footprint equal or exceed the information content of credit bureau scores. Okay, and what they mean by the digital footprint, I'm just going to minimize the window here a little bit because I cannot see the slides entirely. Now it's better. So what's the digital footprint? Well, it seems like it really matters if you're using, for example, an Android-based mobile phone or an Apple iPhone. And it seems it really matters whether, for example, you have an email account open in some sort of in a very, very old server like hotmail.com or yahoo.com. I don't know. Does anybody have the yahoo.com or hotmail.com inbox? No, me neither. I don't know. I don't know those people. Before. I hope none of the distant participants have it. But anyway, so it seems like if you're using particularly the Android mobile phone, and if you have an email account in Hotmail or Yahoo, it seems like you're really, really not a credit-worthy customer. Okay, and this is a very simple digital footprint, because what these guys did is that they accessed, I think it was one of the online platforms from Germany. I don't remember exactly. It was some sort of online store. Maybe even they were selling furniture, but I'm not exactly sure. It's not important. Anyway, so the access, they had a lot of observations. They track how people do the shopping on this platform. And then they simply checked whether the person accessing the platform from the mobile device, what kind of information he or she puts in the registration form, because you need to kind of create an account and so on and so forth, right? So you need to put a lot of stuff. And they found that particular type of customers here stand out. Okay. Well, I have an Android phone, so it's probably not a good sign, but I'm not gonna ask you for your money either. So you shouldn't be worried about that. But I'm gonna take it out just so I would keep the track of time. What it meant. So apparently there are many other examples how this type of information can be used to assess certain type of the customers. Okay. So apparently your phone's battery condition or the drain of the battery could also tell us something about how credit-worthy customer you are. Okay. Apparently your charging habits also can tell whether you're credit worthy or not. So there is a research, it's empirical evidence. I'm not making this up. It's empirical evidence. If you're interested, you can use this paper for a reference. I think it should be in the reference list. But anyways, this is, if you just put this in the Google, you'll find the paper. So so apparently they show that if you are charging, not exactly this paper, but similar papers, easily find it. So if you charge your phone overnight, then it's a sign that you're a very good customer. And apparently your credit scores should be also pretty high. Okay. But then if you're charging your phone not so often in the random occasions, then it might be not such a good sign for some. Okay. So what these guys find is that they compare the credit scores that you get from the credit agency. Right, so the agency which evaluates how credit worthy you are for any loan, they compare whether this other sort of information can provide something else or can provide extra knowledge about people. And it seems like it does, especially in the combination with the credit scores, it actually outperforms any other metric. Okay, and this is cool because I mean, it doesn't take much, it doesn't take a lot of time to extract this information, right? So this is new. We haven't seen that before, right? So we haven't really been, using this type of information before, especially for such serious decisions like to give or not to give the loan from the bank perspective, right? Some banks in some countries, they're starting to do that. They're starting to use this information. Still far away from Europe. You shouldn't be concerned about that. But for instance, in China, it's actually kind of a normal thing nowadays. Okay, that's new. But what's really new is that we also have a handful of different technologies that are really, really disrupting the market right now, and which are really, really kind of changing how the whole business is functioning, banking business. Okay, so we have artificial intelligence / machine learning. We have the natural language processing. We have the RPAs, right? We have the blockchain. And blockchain is not, I'm not talking about the Bitcoin. Blockchain is a technology, right? we have the biometrics, we have the open banking or open APIs for banking. And those are, all of these are actually very, very changing how the field is functioning right now. Okay, we'll talk about it later. So we'll come back to each of them individually. So, but this is just to give you a taste what we're gonna be talking about, what's happening in the banking field. And this is important because it's not only changing how the customers interact with banks, why would we care how they interact? But it's also important from the policy perspective, because now it's much more difficult for the regulators, for instance, to keep a track what is happening in general within the bank and the customer, especially if the bank is not keeping on its balance sheet or on its books their actions. All right, so in the next 2 days, we'll try to go beyond a little bit of this fancy words, fintech, this very fancy word, big tech, or digital banking, it's very fancy. Everybody's talking about it. It's buzzing from all the places, but we'll try to look into a little bit more, you know, fact-based, a little bit more in the research-based evidence and statistical facts. Okay, so we'll see also, I think this is gonna be tomorrow, but we're going to look at the case study from one of the developing countries. Well, it's not a secret. It's going to be China. So we will look how the fintech is actually affecting the market structure. Okay. And it's a real story. It happened just a few years ago. And it's still happening, in fact, but it's to a less extent. So there are some actions. We'll look at it. Highly interactive way, as I told you. Whenever you have something, just ask. Okay, asking questions is free, so I'm not gonna charge you for that. All right, so here is a slight overview, which we're gonna be talking about. So today, I'm not exactly sure where we'll be able to finish, but let's see. So we're gonna talk about the digitalization in the banking sector in general, what's happening, what does it mean, what's the difference with the traditional banking. And then we'll also look at the elements of digital banks. And then I try to come up with some sort of examples to help you to navigate a little bit, because there are so many aspects that sometimes it gets a little confusing. We'll see how the digitalization affects financial intermediation from the process point of view, because it seems like there are also some shifts in the process of the financial intermediation. Okay. Economics of banking and fintechs. So the major question here is actually, can fintechs be some sort of a replacement for traditional banks? In other words, do we need banks, or are we fine with just fintechs? Are we fine with this technology? This is a curious question. How many of you think that we don't need banks and fintechs can do this work just fine? Just a random vote. How many of you think that we don't need banks? Yeah, that's nice, because this is a banking program, right? So it makes sense that you think that banks are actually important. But I asked the same question in the other course. I don't remember which one was that, but it wasn't related to banks. And then I think roughly 50 to 60% of people were voting that we don't need banks. Okay, and this is, it seems like it's a general understanding nowadays in the market, but let's see. I'm on your side in this, okay? So we'll see the COVID effect. This had actually quite interesting, to some extent, quite surprising effect as well. So we'll talk about it a little bit in detail, what's happening and how the COVID changed a little bit the adoption of the fintechs. So, and then hopefully if we manage to do it today, then tomorrow we're gonna talk about the regulation and financial stability, because clearly, for all of us perspective, especially from the perspective of the regulators, policymakers, financial stability is an issue, because it's not really straightforward. How do you facilitate financial stability when you have so many outside non-bank players? Okay. So we'll look at the shadow banking, because most of the shadow banks today are calling themselves digital, at least. So they're kind of calling themselves digital banks, but I'm not exactly sure if this is correct definition, but in any case, they're a pretty big part nowadays of the kind of a banking sector. It's not really a banking sector, but kind of the financial sector. Let's put it this way. What else? So we have, we have the case study, and then we have the as the final part. I'm going to be talking about the impact of this digital banking on the monetary policy transmission, okay. Which is especially relevant today given the situation that we're living in right now. Monetary policy needs to work, but it's not really obvious if it works through non-bank fintechs, for instance, or big techs. Okay. All right, let's roll. So let's look at the digitalization in the banking sector first. So this is a basic graph which shows you the number of bank branches since 2008 up to, end of 2021. So you can see that we are roughly, we're down from 225,000. This is in thousands, 225,000 branches in the EU. We're down to 138. Okay, we're talking only about a few years, right? So we predict a little bit more than 10 years. And this is what's happening. So roughly every third branch has closed between 2017 and 16 alone, 1 year. There were in Germany 70 credit institutions that were closed down completely. 70. 1 year. And this is not, this is not really even a crisis year, right? 16, 17. I think really happened during that time. In Italy, 65 less banks. Is there anyone from Germany or Italy in the class? You're from Germany, yeah. So in Finland, there were 12, minus 12. And here it's more about the cooperative banks. Individual parts of the OP group were closed down. Well, Sweden is a little bit different. While the rest of the world had the minus, Sweden had the plus sign here. So they have opened plus three. I don't know exactly what are these banks that were open, but I'm sure that they're not like really, really traditional, conventional banks as we tend to think about it. Okay. What else? So we have a number of credit institutions. So clearly it's dropping, right? So this is not the branches, but this is the individual credit institutions. So we were roughly at, let's say 8,500. Again, we're talking only about the EU, 27 countries. So roughly from 8,500, we're down to almost 5,000. Okay, so almost double. And then we also have the number of individuals employed by banks. This is probably not very good news for you because you're doing banking degree or degree in banking. So, but it seems like something wrong with the scale. So this should be a little bit lower. I don't know how it happened. But anyway, so we're down from 2.76 million slightly over two. Okay, so roughly, more than half a million. More than half a million of people kind of change their profession. Let's put it this way. Well, I'm sure that you have nothing to worry about your future profession, because I think it's mostly front office employees who kind of have to change. But in any case, so let's see what's happening. Maybe the banking sector is shrinking. Maybe if there is no demand for banking services anymore. Maybe they were overtaken by somebody else or something else. Don't know. Let's see. So let's look at the total assets. So this is the total assets of all banks in the EU from March 2015 to March 2020. And this is quarterly data. Okay. So it seems like, the scale is a little bit not nice. But in any case, so it seems like there are up and downs. So at least in this part, it seems like it's cyclical. And then something happened here, and something happened here, right? So this is, what is that? It's 2018, roughly. This is 2020. So do you know what happened in 2020? Why there is a sudden drop?
COVID-19 virus.
Yeah, but this is, if you look, this is the first quarter of 2020. So COVID-19, I think in Europe, this is EU. So COVID-19 in Europe was already like end of March 2020. So this is already after COVID-19 is somewhere here. But this is a huge drop. Like, you know, what happened in 2020? Any intelligent guesses? Seriously? Okay, this is actually the Brexit effect. Okay, so Brexit took place, but officially only in 2020. Since 2020, the banking sector of the UK was not kind of considered to be part of the EU. So this is the Brexit effect. And other than that, it seems like after the Brexit effect, so you basically subtract UK from here. So we're down from roughly 30 trillion to 25.5 trillion. So that's the UK. But then after that, it seems like it's again, there are up and downs, slight variations. There's some volatility, but it's not, I mean, I wouldn't say that it's significant, right? So you're probably saying here that in 2020, you can see that there is a drop in the number of institutions. So this is the UK effect. But then also it continued to decline after that. Okay, so it's not really driving the trend in a sense. So what's happening? Well, this is what's happening. So we're coming from this type of banking where you actually have to stay in line in order to do your daily financial, I don't know, financial activities, where we're actually down to this. Okay, so you don't have to go to the bank anymore. That's why you don't need the branch anymore. So let's see if it works. I have a short video, which is like 2 minutes, 3 minutes long, which I wanna play. Let's see if it works. It's a YouTube, so it's not. Oh my God. Okay, it's not very straightforward. Let's see if it starts. Okay. Okay, there is an ad. We have to watch the ad first. Okay, skip that. Okay, so we're here. And then I'm just trying to make sure that the distant participants can also see. So maybe here and then. Share sound and also optimize. Now that should work. Okay, it's just a 2 minutes video. Let's see. And it says here, if you can read, it was uploaded in 2018, so roughly 4 years ago. And then it says that what does the future of retail banking look like in 2021? So people in 2018 were trying to predict how the future of banking would look like in 2021. So let's see. Let's see how accurate the prediction was. Okay, so I'll try to put the volume up as well.
Critical burning festival. Yes.
Okay, so it seems like I'm not sure if the distant participants were able to see that. It says that your screen sharing is paused. I'm not exactly sure what it means. But anyways, there is a link. There should be a link in the slide, so you should be able to access it. So it seems like people were okay. There was a message in the chat. Let's see. Oh, you didn't see that. Well, sorry. Tough luck. What I can do is that I can copy the link and I can paste it in the chat. So you can watch it during the break. Okay, it's just 2 minutes, so you didn't lose too much. But can you see the screen now? The slides? Somebody? Yeah. Yes. Okay. Very good. Yes. Very good. I'll make it full screen, and we'll continue rolling. So it seems like in this video, I mean, it's not exactly the same, right? So how we operate, how we do our daily finances today, but a lot of things actually take place, right, in slightly different format, but still they're happening, right? So for example, one of the part of the video was where the confirmation was done by the a kind of a facial recognition, right? So she just showed herself to the phone, and that was the confirmation for some sort of a transaction, right? Bank transaction. Then the other part was that the bank or through the bank services, you were able to do your other type of activities, like for example, searching for the flight tickets, reserving the accommodation, and so on and so forth. And many banks are actually going this direction right now. So they're, instead of being just a financial service provider, they want to become some sort of an ecosystem where there are a lot of many other things that people can do. Okay, so this is happening. This is we're not too far from that. In some countries, this is already the case. Not in Finland, maybe, not yet. At least it's hard to imagine that Nordea or Opa would start offering you to buy flight tickets for them. But let's see, might change. But in general, I mean, today, opening a bank account doesn't take you much, right? So it's almost as easy as signing up for Facebook or opening a Facebook account. Right, 24/7 availability of payments and transfer, even the cross-border, especially within the EU, super easy. Distant savings and investments with online verification. You don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to, basically can do it with the tips of your fingers. Right. So there is no human interaction in everyday banking. So when was the last time you were interacting with anyone from the bank? Probably not recently, right? Unless you got your mortgage just a few days ago. So you didn't have to interact with anyone from the bank. Okay. And then there is also mobile access. You can access your bank accounts even now, right? This is super easy. So a lot of parts from the video was actually true, right? So some things are working, maybe not exactly in the same way, but we're getting there. Not sure, but it didn't happen in 2021, but at least maybe in 2024, 2025, could be easily the case. But the retail banking gonna look like that. So let's see. So before we step in into the real stuff, into the process of financial information, I think it's important to understand what do we mean by a digital bank, because there are some misunderstandings. There are some people are having different kind of opinions about that, and some people are using different definitions. So let's all agree on one definition, which is like conventional definition for the digital bank. So usually when people talk about the digital bank, they think that, okay, it's all about the online banks. If the bank has an online bank, then it's a digital bank. Okay, well, maybe not. Internet banking is only a tool for a distant service, but it doesn't make Liwei Bank a digital bank, right? So then some people think that mobile apps make a bank digital. Well, mobile apps, of course, they kind of make it easier. They make it more accessible and more available services. But again, it doesn't really make the bank digital. Then this is my favorite part, chat bots. This is something that at least banks in Finland has been using now extensively. Chat bots or trading and savings online advisory and so on and so forth. These kind of things make the bank digital. Okay, well, there is a lower interaction with humans, of course, because now you have to go through the hell of communicating with chats, bots, but and at the end of the day, you still end up with the human being who answers your question. Right, but in any case, it's there are some predefined algorithms that these guys are following, so it doesn't make Liwei Bank digital. Some people say that if the bank has no branches, then it's digital. Well, to some extent, yes, but actually there are still some activities that require a physical branch. So there are still some activities in the more sophisticated banking, not an everyday retail banking, but in the more sophisticated banking. There are actually situations when you have to physically go to the bank. Okay, so we still need bank branches. But in any case, a bank without branches, it cannot be really called a fully digital bank, neither. Let's see why. So this is the typical operation chart of any bank, you name it. So there is a front office and there is a back office, right? And in the front office, so this is the customer side. So this is where you and me are kind of observant. So we come to the bank, we see the front office. There's somebody standing there for a chat bot, which answers your questions. And then it also can be organized through the internet or mobile banking, right? So we do interact with the front office. We want to do some activity. The front office takes it from us, and then it transfers that to the back office, right? And then at the back office, there are still people who are actually going through the records. They're doing the clearance, they're doing the maintenance, they're ensuring that they're following the regulations correctly, their compliance and accounting, so everything is done at the back office. Okay. So when we come to the front office, so the interaction between the customer and the bank can be fully automated. Okay. So as you mentioned, or as I mentioned, and you kind of nodded in the response, is that you don't remember when was the last time when you interacted with the human from a bank, right? So this part is automated today, no problems. This part is also mostly automated because the back office is also not, you know, there doesn't require a human being to sit and enter certain records in the particular Excel cell or whatever software they're using. Okay, so there is no need. It's automated as well. I mean, most of the banks today, the interaction between these two channels, between the front office and the back office, is not automated. This is the what's happening today in most of the banks. I'm not telling in all, but in most of the banks today, this interaction is not automated. So there is still somebody, usually it's a human being, who needs to transfer the records from the front office to the back office, or make some sort of authorization or confirmation, or monitoring, and so on and so forth. So there is somebody who needs to make it work. Okay, and this is the pseudo digital bank. But in the fully digital bank, when we're talking about the fully digital bank, and what we mean by digital banking, is that where this part, or this connection between the front office and the back office is automated. Okay, so it's fully automatic. There's nobody in between. There's nobody, you know, in line of the process from the front office to the back office. There is nobody involved. It's a pure machine. Okay. If this can actually automate it, then we can actually consider the bank to be a fully digital bank. So this is the formal definition. So let's stick with this. So it's a full transformation of front-end and back-end operations. In traditional online banking, front-end, right? In addition to that, so all back-end processes are also automated. So there's automated functions, for example, like machine learning or artificial intelligence or the big data analysis or the blockchain. So all these algorithms, they kind of help to automate this link between the front and back offices. So this is what makes bank digital. So the question, natural question here is, why do banks want to be digital? What's the fuss about it? Well, let's see. So obviously the number one reason, which used to be the major reason, was the cost reduction and the cost efficiency, right? So you saw how many people were laid off from the banking sector, right? So this is a huge savings for banking sector simply by introducing online banking, for instance, or mobile banking. Okay. So there are tighter regulations. It used to be negative interest rates, not anymore though, but still negative interest rates for a long time. Minimal margins, they were all affecting the bank profitability. So it was a big time, big issue for banks to stay profitable. Okay. So of course, if you can cut some costs, if you can make it more efficient, it was necessary to some extent for survival of the banks. The second reason is the customers' acquisition and revenue increase. Obviously, with the digital forms of approaching customers, you have a higher chances that you're going to have more customers, right? Because it's so easy now. Everybody can download an app. Nobody has to go to the branch or whatever. So you can just download it and use it. So more people presumably would start using it. So digital banks focus on this enhanced customer experience. The more people enjoy it, the more they're going to use it, and the more the income would generate. Simple logic. And number three is simply staying competitive. And this is probably which is the most important at the moment, because these two were starting to be important at the very beginning of this digital transformation of banking. But now this, I mean, it's probably not in question anymore. But this guy here, it's something which is really important for conventional, for traditional banks right now. Why they want to become digital, why they want to digitalize in general, well, they need to stay competitive. Because there is a huge competition coming from the non-bank fintechs and other shadow banking activities. Okay, so this disruption is really shaking up the banking sector right now. So in order to stay competitive, in order to be in business, stay in business, they actually adopt a lot of other kind of fintech services or digital services. So they need to respond. So for instance, this contactless payments. If you're using the credit card, you probably pay contactless, right? So that was kind of a response to the Apple, Google, or Samsung Pay technologies. There are still some differences between this, but at least banks try to stay competitive from this field. So how do banks become digital? So traditionally, banking is one of the most conservative sectors, okay? So it doesn't like change. It's very conservative. It's been around, the banking business model been around for ages. Okay, I'm not gonna go too far in the history, but trust me, it's been there for a long time. So there's a long tradition of banking services. There are very high barriers to entry. So the capital requirements, I don't remember how much it is exactly right now, but it differs also from country to country. But it's a huge amount of money that needs to be put up front in order to start a bank. Okay. Regulatory environment, outstanding. I mean, the banking sector is the most regulated sector probably out there. Most of the innovative products that we see right now on the market, they actually originated outside of the banking sector. So none of the banks were created anything innovative in the past history. So most of them originated outside. So the fintechs or tech fins initiatives. And as a result, banks are basically the enablers of the technology and definitely not the creators. So they're borrowing this technology, they're using this technology, but they don't create it. Okay. And this is the elements of the digital bank. So in different sources, there are different kind of definitions of the elements again, because the whole field is very new. So we're not talking about the digital banking, let's say 10 years ago. Nobody really was taking it serious, but now it seems like it's a big thing. So that's why people try to structurize it and put a little bit more kind of effort in giving names to certain things. So this is one of the structure of how the digital banking nowadays functions. Okay, so now this is all the elements. There are different, as I told you, there are different various ones, but I like this one the most. So there are basically three components. First one is new banks, so-called challengers. I don't know if you heard about it, but challengers is also kind of a fancy word, buzzy word. So it's rather rare event. So a complete new bank challenger is rather rare event because these guys usually have a full complete banking license from the regulator, from the central bank, okay? So they have the complete right to offer traditional banking services, but they're doing it different, okay? So they're doing it in a digital way. Then there are neobanks. Neobanks, well, basically it also means new banks, but it's not exactly new banks because they usually, most of the time, they don't have a banking license, okay? So they're not, they cannot really be considered as a bank from the regulatory perspective. But what they do is that they cooperate with other real banks in order to provide some sort of bank licensed services. And then there is a bunch of non-bank fintechs, which we're going to be talking about a little bit later on. There's a huge amount of them. But those are ventures that offer, most of the time, they simply offer a very, very limited type of the financial service, but to a very broad customer base. Okay, to a lot of people, but very limited. So usually they focus around, let's say, payments, and then they specialize in payments, and then they offer the service. But they're still not a bank. They're not doing anything related to the banking. But then, of course, it affects the rest of the banking sector, right? Because now people, instead of doing the payments through the bank, they do it somewhere else. Okay, has an effect. But let's see. Let's look at it. So this is kind of the elements of the digital banking. Let's look at each of them individually. I have examples here. So this is new bank, Monzo. Okay, it's a fully digital bank founded in the UK in 2015. It set the record for the quickest crowdfunding campaign in history. So it basically raised £1 million in 96 seconds. Okay, so that was the fastest crowdfunding campaign. It reached roughly 1 million customers by 2018, so just in 3 years. Currently, or at least as of 2020, they didn't release, or they might have released, but I didn't really find it. So as of 2020, they have 4.4 million customers. Okay, so 4.4 million, sizable amount, right? So valuations, again, in July 2020 were 1.25 billion of British pounds. And then they also entered the US market in 2019 via some sort of a partner bank. So what they do, they're a fully digital bank, okay? So they didn't have any branches. They provide all these services online. And also some of the interactions between the front office and the back office is also fully automated. So they use the modern technologies to automate the banking process, okay? But what they do right now is that they offer a kind of a limited banking service. So it's limited to only mostly to deposits and mostly to very, very small, tiny loans, either to the retail customers or then some sort of entrepreneurs. Okay. So it's a limited, it's still a banking service, right? But it's kind of a little bit limited. Let's see next. So we have a new bank. So this is the, I don't know, have you heard about this guy right here? No? Okay, well, it's not a surprise because it's a US-based banking firm. Okay, so it's not really a bank, but in a way they position themselves as a bank. So it was founded in 2013 and the catch of this company was that they offered a fee-free account, which were very rare at that time among the other traditional conventional US banks. Okay, so usually if you need to have a bank account in the US, you have to pay some sort of a monthly fee, like almost like a subscription fee for the banking services for the daily in order to have the internet banking and so on and so forth. So there is a, it varies, but it's something like, let's say $50 per month on average. So these guys opened in 2013 and they say, hey, it's free, come over. We don't charge anything, but you can do the same type of activities. We still offer you the access to your accounts through the online banking. You get a card, a Visa debit card, or I'm not sure, they might have issued even the credit cards as well. And then you can do the same kind of daily banking, just like in any other bank. So the catch here is that if we're talking about large US banks, so they, on average, they were making over $1 billion US dollars per year in these fees related kind of activities, right? So they made $1 billion a year by just charging these monthly fees for having an account. Okay. So these guys come and they say, hey, we want a piece of this $1 billion, but we're going to make it free, right? So obviously it started to shrink significantly. So the Chime makes more, they actually wanted to, their business model is that they wanted to make money on this interchange. So interchange is basically every time when you pay with your card, there is the small amount which is transferred by the card issuer to this operator. And it's still happening. So banks are doing the same thing. So that's why sometimes you can get a cash back. For instance, S-Bank in Finland offers a small, was it like 0.5% cash back if you pay with their kind of credit card or debit card, right? So this is something which they take back from this interchange and offer you in return for using their services. So most of the banks were doing that as well. And the Chime said, hey, we also want to do that, but we're going to do it for free. So we're going to make money. We're not going to offer you cash back, but we're going to take this interchange to ourselves, but the rest of the service is going to be free for you. Okay. So as of February 2020, it had 8 million accounts. And it was up from 1.5 million since 2018, so 2 years earlier. So you can see that they grew, well, six times basically in 2 years period, or less than 2 years period. Okay, so not a big brainer, right? Because it's free, people are using it, it's the same, it works. It actually had the biggest inflow of new customers was registered in February 2018. So they opened 10,000 new accounts in 24 hours, okay? 10,000 in 24 hours. And that was largely due to the some sort of outage at Wells Fargo. So Wells Fargo services were down for one day, or basically for a few hours. So you couldn't use their credit cards or debit cards, and you couldn't access your accounts as well. There you go. 24 hours, 10,000 new customers to China. Cool. So in May 2021, they were actually, the Chime were forced by the court. So they were forced to stop using the term bank in their marketing and campaigns as some sort of regulatory push. Because before they were using the word bank a lot and they were comparing themselves to the bank. But in fact, they're not, because they didn't have a full banking license. And if you read here somewhere in the very, very small, so this is a snapshot of their web page. So if you read here in the very, very small, tiny letters, it says that you probably can't see it, but I can read it for you. So banking services provided by the Bancorp Bank or Stride Bank, and then which are the members of the FDIC. So they provide the traditional banking services are provided through the real banks. Okay, so this is their catch. This is new bank. So Juha mentioned that I've been doing this guest lecture for some time now, well, maybe three or four times, maybe three. And before on my slides, I had this Lunar Way as an example of the new bank. And what happened is that on what we observe in general on the market is that these new banks, they tend to shift and transfer to new banks, okay? Mm-hmm. So instead of being kind of pseudo banking service provider, they actually decide, or I'm not sure if they are forced to issue a full banking license and start operate as the real bank. Okay, so this is 2019. This should be more familiar. Has anybody heard about Lunar Wave? Okay, because this is not too far from here. It's a Danish venture, so it's from Denmark. So in 2019, this is what you could read on their webpage. At Lunar Way, we're innovating the banking experience and the way we all think about the money and spending in our everyday life. We're not a bank, we're better. This is a real sentence which was on the webpage of the Lunar Way 2019. So it was born in 2015, by the way, in Aarhus. It's an app-based fintech, used to be. And it used to partner with the licensed New Credit Bank. So New Credit Bank, for your information, it was founded in 1851. It's one of the oldest banks, actually, in the Nordics, right? So, and it's the largest financial institution in Denmark. So, yeah, so they were partnering a lot. But then in 2020, they were kind of, probably to some extent, they were forced to change from a non-bank experience to a real bank experience, because now it says that we're just as any other Danish bank under the supervision of the Danish FSA. Okay, there you go. So this is what happened in the market right now, because there are a lot of companies which started as the fintech, as some sort of a technologically advanced companies that try to provide financial services in a better way. When we see that these companies transform nowadays to a real banks, to the normal, the regulatory supervised banks. Okay. So we got the banking license in 2019, by the way. All right. And then we have, so this is just the snapshot how the development of this field looks like. So this is the new banks worldwide. And this is the largest ones. So there is a new bank in Brazil. There is a Vault in the UK, China in the US. There are a bunch of other ones, but this is just 2 years. Okay, so this is 2020, the blue line, the light blue line, 2020, and then the dark blue is 2021. So within 1 year, you can see that in all of the cases, wherever we look, the violations were gained up. And it's happening all over the place, basically worldwide. It doesn't matter if it's Brazil, UK, US, there is even one from Russia. Well, I'm sure that this guy right now is probably experiencing some problems right now at the moment, but let's see. So, but anything, there is one in Germany, N26. Some other UK and US. And I think this is not even including the Chinese ventures. Okay, but you can see that the valuations of these companies is soaring. So there is a huge uptick. So for the Brazilian one, it went from 10 to 45 billion US dollars in valuations. Huge increase. So this market for this new and challenger banks is growing very rapidly. Okay, it's expected to grow at an annual average rate of roughly 50%, all the way up to 2030. And then if this would be the case, then we should expect that the whole size of this market would be over $2 trillion US dollars by 2030. Okay. All right. And then we have the last part, last element of the digital banking is the non-bank, right? So non-bank can be anything. It can be related to payments like Samsung Pay, Google Pay, Apple Pay, whatever pay. So this is all about payments. They didn't do much more than just facilitate in a more advanced way how you do your payments in the daily life, right? So it's a very disruptive technology because now you can pay with all, it seems like with anything that you have on you, with any gadget that you have on you, would it be a watch, a cell phone, whatever, a ring, you can pay with the ring. So that's crazy, right? So ring payments. Very disruptive, and banks are actually being charged for that. So if somebody is using, for instance, Apple Pay, who ties the credit card of the other bank to the Apple Pay, so the bank actually being charged roughly, well, it's anywhere between 0.05 to 0.3% per transaction. So this is, I mean, this, these are the costs for the bank, right? So they don't like this, obviously. Contactless debit cards usually have a limit of only, in Finland, it's only 50 euros. And in many other countries, it's also 50 euros. Well, Apple Pay doesn't have any limit. You can pay any amount with an Apple Pay or Google Pay. Anything would work, right? So it's hard to compete with that as well. For the traditional conventional banks. And then there is also something which is called Apple Cash. Well, it hasn't been really used widely in Europe, but at least in the US, there is a possibility to transfer the money through the iMessage. Okay, if you use an iPhone, you should know what iMessage is, and you can transfer money with that by just simply texting this. So then there is another non-bank activity which is related to lending. There is a so-called lending club. It's got to be quite famous, but it's okay if you haven't heard that. It's actually, I think it's still the biggest lending, P2P lending platform in the world, but there is another one which is, I think it's prosper.com, which is also catching up very, very quickly with this lending club. Okay, so it's a P2P lending company with roughly 50 billion US dollars in loans. It allows individuals to create loan listings, and then the lending club tries to pre-screen the customer, the borrowers, and then they kind of they verify whether it's the right person or not, and then they also do some sort of screenings of the credit histories. Then based on this information, very limited, tiny fraction of this information, they make some sort of an offers or suggestions what should be the interest rate on the loan that the people are asking. Okay, so, and then individuals like you and me, I call them investors, they can go to this web page and then they can browse the individual listings and they can create their own portfolio of loans that they want to grant. But I think the minimum amount was something like $25 each. You couldn't put less than $25. Okay, so this is the lending. And then there is another, I call it simply other because there are so much other things included in this. For example, from the investor's point of view, there are a lot of investment, different type of investment apps, right? So for instance, for the retail trading, even now, to some extent, it's not very, if you want to trade through your bank, for instance, you still need to sign some sort of an agreement. And then you probably need to pay some sort of maintenance fee or whatever fee for every month that you're trading in, and so on and so forth. So it's easy to some extent, but it's not very easy. So some people who are laying on the couch and want to buy a stock probably would not go through the difficulties of making the trading agreement with Nordea, for instance, right? But these disruptive technologies that we see right now on the market, they're actually super easy. Anybody can start trading stocks. Okay. Anybody can start trading in options. Okay. Or any other kind of derivative instruments. So before this was the case, the individual investors, like retail traders, were making up just 10% of the market rates in 2019. And market rates, I'm in the S&P 500 transactions. Okay. So transactions in S&P 500. So, or in general in the US, okay, let's put it this way, that's easier. 10% of all the market trades were due to the retail customers. But today it's roughly 25%. It's probably even more now, but at least before the COVID or during the COVID, it was 25%. That's a huge fraction, right? So it's one fourth of all the transactions made in the stock market are coming from the retail individual investors. Okay. So why does it matter? Well, let's see. So this is the graph right here. It shows the S&P index, S&P 500 index, and then the number of the Robinhood. Have you heard about Robinhood? Some nodding like this or like this would help. Yeah, you heard about Robinhood, good. So this is the Robinhood users positions in the S&P 500 stocks. and this is in Milan. Okay, so this is COVID right here. So you can see that before COVID, Robinhood existed before COVID, by the way. But before COVID, there was a quite linear, smooth growth, smooth increase. So they were in June 18, they were roughly 3.5 million transactions. And then by December 2019, let's say they were, well, a little bit over 4. Okay, so smooth growth. But then during the COVID, there was a huge uptick right here. So it went up to 12, which is, well, more than 3 times of an increase. Okay. Has a huge implications because now it seems like we should worry not only about the institutional investors, which are doing some things on the stock market, but they're also huge power. Everybody heard about the meme stocks, right? So when there are retail traders combined together and then they start doing nasty things to the institutional investors. So it seems like it's a powerful source. I mean, it's funny now, because we're talking about individual specific stock. Oops, sorry. But if we would be talking about more serious implications, then that would be a huge impact on the, I mean, in general, on the financial stability, right? So, and why this is happening? Well, of course, COVID had an effect. COVID had a huge effect. And then, because many received the stimulus checks, at least in the US, to survive the lockdowns. And since many casinos were closed down, you couldn't go because of the pandemic. Obviously, the obvious kind of solution or closest substitute, let's put it this way, was the stock market, right? And then there is also the Robinhood. Originally, every time when you were making a trade, let's say you were buying a stock, it also had a lot of animation. So there were some fireworks and they tried to make it, when you hit the buy button, they tried to make it as a party going on, right? So they were congratulating with a lot of animations. They were putting a lot of effort into indicating that you did something right. So there was it makes you, to some extent, it makes you feel good, right? So when you do something and then it shows that it's a good thing that you're doing, then you want to do it more, right? So these gamifications, they were actually forced to remove this animation from the app at some stage. I don't remember when exactly, but they were forced to remove this because there were people were claiming that it affects the behavior of investors. Of course, the quarantine limits the other activities, but trading can be done basically from anywhere. By laying on the couch in isolation, it's very easy to start buying and selling stocks. Okay. So it has a huge impact. Okay. The bottom line here is that it has a huge effect. So we're roughly 1 hour, 10 minutes through. So I suggest that we take a couple of more slides, and then if you want, we can have a short break. Okay. So this is the number of fintech startups worldwide. So there are more than 25,000 specialized fintech firms in wide areas from the payments to the P2P lending platforms, from insurance to investment management services. So 25,000. The biggest questions here, it would be fine if they would be, you know, working in their own area without interacting too much with their other sectors. But the biggest question here is that do they compete or do they complement the traditional banking services, the conventional banking? Will they replace the bank? I don't know. What are the implications for financial intermediation in general as the process? This is probably the biggest question here. And then also, what are the implications for financial stability then? So we'll try to look into this a little bit later on today and tomorrow. Okay. All right, so let's have a, 10 minutes break. Is that good? Yeah, 10 minutes break. So see you back at 1:35. Hello. Okay, let's move on. So let's try to find the answers. Let's see if I can get my clicker. Yeah. So let's try to find the answers to these questions that we kind of ended up with in the last slide. So what are the implications for the financial intermediation? And the biggest question is whether the fintechs and non-bank digital disruptors can actually substitute or replace the traditional banks. Okay. So let's see. Let's see how the digital disruption affects the financial intermediation at first place, right? So, this is wrong. So it's intermediary bank. It should be separate words, but in any case. So I'm very good in illustrating certain things, okay? So this is my chart, which I created. So I hope you like it as well. It's not good at all. But in any case, if I want to illustrate the traditional financial intermediation process, I would probably do it in this way, okay? So I have a bank in the center. I have the depositors, like you and me, or maybe even companies, who come to the bank and then they bring the deposits, right? So I have, as a bank, I also have some sort of debt holders, right? And then the equity holders or the shareholders. So these guys bring the uninsured debt. Uninsured, it means that it's not part of the deposit insurance system, right? And then the shareholders bring the equity to the bank. So as a bank, I take all these funds and then I redistribute them, right? So I usually, as a traditional bank, I give out loans. Okay, so I give out loans to the borrowers, would it be the private individuals or the companies, doesn't matter. And then what happens then is that the borrowers, they make the interest payments and then the principal payments back, right? So as a bank, again, I collect these payments. What I do then is that I pay also some sort of an interest on my deposits in order to track more of them, right? Especially, well, now with the when we're in a positive interest rate environment, this is probably going to be again the case. It wasn't really the case for some time, but now we're probably going to be back to normal in a sense. So if you have any deposits in the bank, probably it will start at some stage generate a positive interest as well. So I pay this interest on my deposits, and then I also do the repayments to the debt holders, right? So I pay the interest and I pay the principal. And then if I have anything, any residual earnings, I redistribute it to the shareholders, right? So what I do also as a bank, what's my value here is that as the financial intermediary, is that I offer the depositors, the debt holders, and the shareholders, I offer these services. So I tell them that, hey, I'm gonna do for you the risk assessment, I'm gonna do the monitoring, I'm gonna build also the relationship with my other customers, with the borrowers, okay? And this just comes as the process of the financial intermediation. So I do all this for you, so you don't have to worry. Especially the depositors. Depositors don't worry at all because they're insured to some extent. In many countries, there is a deposit insurance system, which basically promises that people will get their money back, whatever happens. If the bank fails or whatever happens, they're gonna get their money back. Okay, so, but in any case, I do this thing in order to ensure that I'm a strong, stable bank, which doesn't end up in trouble. What I also do is that I take as the intermediary, I take the credit risk, I take the interest rate risk, and I take the currency risk, especially if I'm a big bank which operates in different markets, right? In different countries, in different currencies as well. So I take all these risks and then I show them, or at least they can be seen from my books, right? From a balance sheet, from the income statement, the cash flow. You can see that. You can see, you can analyze, you can assess, you can quantify this risk, right? So this is traditional, right? So if I want to, if somebody would ask me to draw a financial intermediation structure or a process, this is what I will end up with. Let's see. Let's assume now that instead of the bank, we have some sort of the P2P lending platform. Would it be a lending club or the prosper.com, whatever. It's non-bank, non-bank institution, it's a fintech, but it offers quite similar type of the services, right? So it offers a platform where people can come and lend money to other people most of the time, right? So now the people who are bringing in the money, they're not really depositors, right? So because they're not depositing their money directly to the P2P platform, but they're rather investing the money into the some sort of a portfolio of ventures, right? To the portfolio. So they're not really depositors, so they become investors. What happens then? This part, it actually doesn't exist anymore because there are no debt holders. There are no people who use debt or who provide debt to a P2P platform, which then would be used to provide loans. They don't do that. Okay, so they don't take any additional debt to provide loans. Moreover, they don't put their own money into provided provision of loans, right? So they might use some debt and they might use some of their own money in order to build this platform to make it technologically advanced, but essentially they're not transferring this money further on to the financial intermediation process. They're not making loans out of this money. So we can forget about it and just throw it away, right? So then here, this part. P2P lending platform, they do the pre-screening, yes. They do the initial assessment. So they verify their customers. So they make sure that those are the right people and not some sort of a random scams in most of the cases, at least. Essentially, they're definitely not building any relationships with these guys or with the borrowers. They don't want this relationship, right? Because they're not putting their own money. Why would they want this relationship then, right? So, and then they're not monitoring. So they don't care if the loans on this side would go back. So they don't care, okay? And then also this part right here, the credit risk, interest rate risk, and currency risk, it's not a headache of the P2P lending platform. Okay, so because they are not using any of their money, they don't care about the risk. So if I rearrange it, so this part is gone. And then if I rearrange it a little bit, so it basically transforms all the risks and all the headache of the investors themselves. Right, so the investors bear all this credit risk, interest rate risk, and if it's in different currencies, investors, it's also going to be the currency risk and all other risks. And I didn't list all of them, but there are many other risks as well. So there is some sort of a pre-screening based on the data and the hard data most of the time, instead of the relationship lending. And then there's the borrowers, they make some sort of repayments, basically straight to the investors, but then of course the P2P platform, they want to keep their fractions. They charge for the services. Okay, so this is the kind of a financial intermediation structure or scheme when there's a fintech. So instead of intermediation, what they're doing is that they are disintermediate. Okay, so that's why I call it a financial disintermediation up here. Right. And this has become interesting because now instead of financial intermediation, we have financial disintermediation. And what to do with that? I mean, we don't know yet. We're not used to this kind of processes. So imagine if all the banks would suddenly become like this. Well, it's going to be probably problematic for many central banks, many regulators. But let's see. So these are kind of the cost and benefit analysis, okay? So let's see. So we have the conventional banking on the left-hand side, and then we have the non-bank fintechs on the right-hand side. So conventional banks, they pool and share all the associated risk, right? So when I give out the loans, I'm not just using one particular depositor's money, one particular person who brought a lot of money to the bank as a deposit, and then I'm taking this money and giving to one particular borrower. Right, so I'm pooling all together. So even if this borrower would fail, then it doesn't mean that this one depositor would lose all the money. No, because I can pool, I can share. This is not the case in the fintech, because if you're, as the investor, investing in the bad loans, if this loan would fail, it means that you as the investor would lose all the money. Okay, so this thing is tremendously good. Monitoring, there is no monitoring in fintech. It just tells you, well, yes, it's still rolling, or then no, there is no borrower anymore. Okay, so there's no monitoring. Well, the banks, actually, they do that. When I used to work at the bank, we used to do, I think it was every quarter, where we had to ask for a financial statement from the company and then assess how well the company is doing and whether it's able to keep its promises, basically, with respect to the repayment. Okay, sometimes it might be happening even more often. Sometimes it could be on a monthly basis, depending on the type of the loan. Liquidity creation, liquidity. I mean, these guys, when we are trying to think about financial intermediation function through the fintechs, the problem is that they don't create any liquidity. So they simply provide a meeting place where investors meet the borrowers, another way around, right? So we cannot really say that, imagine if tomorrow there will be nobody willing to invest anymore. So then this P2P platform should be closed, because there will be no activity. For banks, it's not the case. Banks create liquidity by taking the deposits in. So, and this is a very, very liquid, for deposit from the depositor's point of view, this is very, very liquid source of capital, because deposits, you as a depositor, so you can go to the bank and withdraw your deposit at any point of time. So for you, it's very liquid. And then what bank does is that it takes its very liquid funds and then it gives out loans, which are very, very illiquid for bank, because bank cannot go to the borrower and say, hey, I want my money back tomorrow. Right? So it's impossible. You as a bank, you commit that at least for a certain period of time, this loan will be active. Right? So that's why there's no liquidity creation in terms of the fintechs. Loan commitments, again, it's not necessarily only about loans, right? It also could be loan commitments. So the credit lines, for instance, if you're a company which is operating in a highly intensive working capital environment, you probably would need to have some sort of support from your financial institution who say, hey, yeah, whatever you need, just call us. So credit lines are not, at least so far, I haven't seen any single case of a credit line provided by a fintech. Just doesn't exist. And then maturity transformation, of course. I mean, you can open a deposit for only 6 months, but then the loans are given out for 5, 10, mortgages are 25, 30 years, right? So there is a maturity transformation, which doesn't happen on this side at all. And then, of course, there are a lot of differences in the how it's funded, how it's functioning. So banks are leverage and equity funded, which operate in the highly regulatory and cost restrictive environment. And then these guys are operating, they're usually all equity financed, but this equity, of course, is not used forward to make the loans, but they don't care about, I mean, they didn't have any other stakeholders most of the time. There are some cases where it's debt financed, but it's private investments most of the time. And then there's a very, very low regulatory burden. So basically, if we go back, let's say 3 to 4 years ago, there's basically no regulation at all how this B2B platform should function. Now they're starting to make it a little bit framed, but still it's very, very low. And then, the major part is this deposit insurance. Nobody guarantees that you're going to get your money back from a B2B platform. Okay? This is the biggest difference. Intermediation versus disintermediation. So, and here are the other examples as well. So if you think about the Uber, sure you heard about that, right? Okay, so Uber is the world's largest transportation company at the moment, but it owns no cars. And there is Facebook, it's the world's most popular media, social media, that creates no content. Facebook itself doesn't create any content at all. Then Airbnb is the largest accommodation provider, which basically owns no property. Can this be applied to banks? Nah, I don't know. So, I mean, the biggest question here is that can any of the provider of the real banking service, the full banking service, exist or operate with such a thin balance sheet? Okay. Because the biggest problem here, is that these guys, they don't show any of these risks on their balance sheets, simply because they don't take it, right? So it's not their risk, so why should it be shown here? So think about it from the financial stability perspective, from the regulatory perspective. How can you quantify something which is not visible? You're not gonna go to the balance sheets of individual people, right? Because they don't report these balance sheets. So how can you, I mean, how can you assess it? How can you quantify it? So it has a huge implications for the financial stability. We'll take a look at that a little bit later on, but we will talk about it. Okay, so now the next question, will these disintermediates be able to replace the intermediates? Basically, will this fintechs replace the conventional banks? Well, we have some theoretical predictions and we have some empirical evidence. Let's look at those. So usually banks are leverage lenders, right? So they're not using their own money. They take the money from somebody and then put it forward. So they're leverage lenders and therefore they have a risk shifting moral hazard, of course, within the regulatory framework and requirements. But in any case, if there's some sort of a shock, let's say the interest rates drop suddenly and then the deposits go and withdraw their money because they think that it's not a profitable investment anymore for them. So they try to look for the other opportunities. So there should be a shift also in the bank lending, right? Because now they have less funding available from the deposit side, especially if it's a core deposits, which are in some countries are the most important source of funding for banks. So now they simply shift this moral hazard. They say, hey, we don't have money, though. That's why we cut our lending. That's it. So in case of the P2P platforms, they're all equity financed lenders, but they do not have any moral hazard with that. So they will continue to operate as they were, as long as there are investors who think that it's a good venture to invest to be involved in the P2P lending, okay? So whenever there is another exogenous shock in the credit supply, the bank lending should be affected first. So banks would cut on lending, but potentially the P2P lending may offer a substitution effect, right? Because now there might be the case that all these depositors who withdraw all the money from the bank deposits, they're gonna bring it to the P2P platform, which offers a good interest rates for the investments and put the money there. Right, so this is the theoretical. This is how it should work in theory. Does it work in practice? Well, let's see. We have a very, very limited empirical evidence, okay? Because this is a very, very new thing. So that's why there is not that much of research done on this topic, but we still have some of it. So this is a 2019 paper, Review Financial Studies, again, top finance journal. So what it finds is that P2P lending expands in the market exposed to the negative bank credit supply shock. But this expansion benefits only a very, very particular type of the customers. Okay, so it says that it's inframarginal bank borrowers and complements bank credit only in providing very, very small loans. Okay, so when we're talking about the corporate loans or loans for medium businesses, which is very important in the times of the some sort of the financial turmoil, it cannot. Okay, so it doesn't substitute. Okay, so theoretical prediction doesn't work here, at least according to this paper. You can check. I think I have it in the references. You can check what kind of data, but I think it's a US based evidence. Number two, it's still a working paper, but it's also very fresh, 2019. So I think when it gets published, it's gonna be 2022, probably, evidence, 2022 paper. So if banks are affected by exogenous shock, P2P lenders will fill the gap only if there are unaffected financially strong banks. Okay, so there is a condition for that. If there are some financial institutions which are unaffected, then the P2P would fill the gap, which is created by this exaggeration. P2P lenders make riskier loans than banks. And then if you look at the risk-adjusted interest rate, it's actually lower in bank loans than from the P2P provider. Okay, what it means is that whoever is borrowing from a P2P platform, they have to bear a higher borrowing cost. Okay, and sometimes it's not really a good thing. One more paper, still working paper, but it 2020. So again, when it published 2022 or 2023, it can be very recent. So fintechs tend to replace the small and medium loans by large banks more than small banks. And this is consistent with the financial technology advantages in more efficient kind of processing of the information rather than hardening of the soft information. But the fintechs loans are relatively risky. They become safer after replacing bank loans. Of course, probably it's the kind of bank customers that try to look somewhere else for funding. But in general, both fintechs and bank loans are found to benefit the real economy and kind of to complement each other rather than substitute each other. Okay. So we have three points of empirical evidence that show that, let's see if I have a summary page. Well, it's coming, it's probably coming after this one. But in general, it shows that it does not necessarily follows 100% the theoretical predictions, right? So there is some variation how these P2P lenders are able to fill the gap whenever there is a really big summer shock with the credits. Let's see. Why this is happening, why there is a big difference between the empirical evidence and theoretical prediction. Well, maybe this one, this is why. Remember we were talking about these new banks. And new banks are some sort of financial service providers that do not have the banking license of their own, but they tend to partner with other real banks to do some sort of financial activity. So we have if you have a depositor which is who are interested in bringing money to the new bank, usually new banks, they cannot take this money directly because they are not a bank. They don't have a banking license. Right. So what they have to do is that they have to partner with traditional bank and then accept those deposits through this partner bank. OK. All right. How much sense does it make? I don't know. But then same actually happens with on the other side with the borrowers. So, of course, some of the new banks can provide the money directly to the borrowers, but most of them prefer actually to partner with other traditional banks in order to provide the lending because. In this case, in the direct lending, it cannot really be called lending because if that would be a lending, then this bank would have to fulfill all the other requirements which are there in place from the regulators. Okay, and because they don't want to take these requirements, they tend to partner with a traditional bank who knows how to do that and who does that. Okay. So the key feature here is the absence of the banking license for the new banks that allows to transfer the risk and regulatory burden on other banks. So whenever there is some sort of external exogenous shock on the credit supply, so this bank is also affected, the new bank, because now the partner banks are affected as well. Right? So these activities of this bank would be also affected. So that's why the empirical evidence is mixed. So these partners, they provide the core back office operations. But most often, these new banks, they deliver only the service, not really the product. They outsource the product to other traditional banks. Okay, so they just provide service in the same better way. So this is the summary page that I was looking for. So what is the impact of this financial intermediation? From the digitalization of the banking sector. So these are the main key takeaways. So for the non-banks, we see that they do act as the disintermediators on the market, but they are rather complementary to traditional banking. They're not substitutes. Okay, so they just add more. They do not keep risk that they originate on their books. And this is the problem for the regulators. This is still a big point of discussion right now. For the new banks, so these are the new kind of type of banks which operate without the bank license. So they do I call them indirect intermediation because they have all these partner banks to help them with. So it's kind of additional intermediation. It's not really a disintermediation or intermediation. It's additional because they simply outsource the other partner banks. So again, they just supplement to the traditional banks. They're not a substitute here. And then conventional banks take all the associated risk with the deposits or with the loans of these banks. So they show it on their books instead. Okay. And then the new banks. So those are the tricky ones because they do provide the services in a much more efficient way. Other banks as well, but most of the time they are very focused, they're very specialized. Okay, so I have so this is would be if I want to put it in two bullet points here. So all these guys, digital banks, let's call them collectively like this, they provide services that traditional banks do less efficiently or do not do at all, but essentially they cannot replace banks in most of their key functions, like liquidity creation, credit assessment, and so on and so forth. So this is the key takeaway should be for you. Any questions? Okay, if not, let's move on. Let's talk now about the economics of banking and fintechs. Let's see how it functions now. Okay, so let's look at a little bit in the Let's go a little bit deeper in that and see how it functions in particular. So the major functions of banks, to grant loans and to take deposits, right? So financial intermediation functions. So this function kind of by default makes them capable to provide or to perform three primary sets of activities. So the first one is to the transforming the characteristics of financial assets and liabilities, right? So you take something which is very liquid, like a deposit, and you transform it into something very illiquid, like a bank loan, right? Then the second one is providing the payment service, right? Because in order to take deposits and give out loans, you need to have some sort of function and system which would be responsible for these transactions, right? So by default, banks are entitled to have this part of the process working. And then the third one, and this is the most interesting part, is the processing of information. Because the pre-screening and credit assessment of borrowers, monitoring and relationship building, nobody said that these are completely useless tasks, right? So they still add a significant fraction into the banking service in general, okay? So all these three, services, they kind of come together, right? When we talk about the conventional bank, they come together. So they're provided in a bundled way. So it's just a bundled service. When you bring the deposit to the bank, you make it through the payment service, and then the same happens with the loan. And then if you want to borrow, you go through the information processing. And so on and so forth, right? So it kind of functions as a well-oiled machine in a traditional bank. When it comes to the fintechs, they pretty much do the same type of set of services, but the problem is that they tend to focus or they tend to orient only in the particular type of the service. So I made the size of the circles different on purpose because most of the fintechs right now, as of today, they're actually in payments. So if you look at the description of any of the fintechs, you will see that majority of them will be focusing on the payments. Then some of them operate as some sort of a P2P platform, for instance, some sort of focus on findings, right? And then there is a very, very small fraction of in-text that focuses on the information process, okay? So the thing is that they are very focused, most of the in-text very focused, and they provide the services in an unbundled way. So if you want to use, for instance, Apple Pay, you probably won't be able to open a deposit account with Apple Pay. At least so far, it's not possible. Same goes with the B2B platform. If you want to get a loan, you probably also cannot open a deposit account with the B2B platform, right? And the same here. So nothing works in a combined way. And this is kind of how it functions today. But what we see also is that these fintechs from individual companies, they tend to kind of merge quite a bit and converge into a traditional bank and service business model. Okay. At least so far, it's been the ultimate goal of many of the fintech companies. This is what we observe. We observe the convergence of their unbundled way of providing services into a more bundled, more kind of complete service provider. Let's look at each individual type a little bit more in detail. So when we're talking about the assets and liability transformation, so this is related to the liquidity creation things, right? So when you have a bank, so you take deposits and you give out loans, but then all depositors can withdraw the money, so it's very liquid for them. But then loans are usually longer maturity, so they cannot be withdrawn by the bank, so they're very liquid. When there is no bank, depositors cannot withdraw, and the same, I mean, this part is unchanged. It's because the loans cannot be withdrawn, so that's why the depositors cannot withdraw, right? So asset and liability transformation doesn't happen in the absence of the financial institution. When we talk about the payments, so this is, as I told you, this is the largest part of the fintechs. They're doing it, of course, more efficiently. They're doing it very nicely. To a large extent because of the advanced technologies, right? So Apple Pay, when you pay with the ring or with the watch, that's a technology and it's fantastic. And that's why they're so popular, right? So, but most of the time, these companies are also using the economies of scope, economies of scale, doesn't matter, because they have such a huge customer base, right? So when you introduce a technology where you already have a huge customer base, it makes things a little bit easier, right? So that's why we see that all the big techs like Apple, Samsung, Google, even Amazon are actually talks right now that Amazon would open their own bank, basically, because they're already doing some of the services, financial services. So Amazon is providing lending to people and to entrepreneurs, well, basically to companies. Okay, so and the information that they're using there in order to provide a loan is not really conventional. So instead of looking at your balance sheet and income statement, they look how many trades or how many purchases there were made on Amazon if you're a company operating in Amazon. They look at how many purchases have been made in Amazon, who are the customers, and what's the general your rating of the product. If everybody gets a good review, then probably you have a high chances to get a loan. But if your product gets a low review, probably you're not going to get that much. Right? So they're using alternative information, which is not easily accessible. It's accessible to some extent, but it's not easily accessible by other players. I don't see that any of the conventional bank right now, when assessing an application from an entrepreneur who operates in Amazon, I don't think that any of the bank managers would go to Amazon and actually check how many reviews and what's the average review, what kind of feedback the entrepreneur gets on Amazon. But these guys do, and they're being quite successful at this. Okay, so they're starting to offer these bank-like services because their economies of scope are huge and information process. Okay, this is their major advantages. So they analyze the purchases, payments, internet searches, are all these elements of this big data that they're analyzing. analysis of which allows them to evaluate the client's credit risk and possibility better, possibly better than banks can do. Okay. And then these technological advantages and economies of scale allow these new players on the market. But I mean, banks are not locked in their rooms, in their own world. So that's why they're adopting pretty much the same technologies and doing it very successfully so far. So actually, let's say some of the very successful fintech startups either have or then obtained a very, very good support from the real kind of traditional bank. Okay, but and by support I mean the investment. Okay, so most of the investors in these startups are actually banks themselves. But it doesn't come that the banks start out their own venture, but they see that somebody is doing it in a better way. And they're very early in the process, they step in and they grow the startup. So banks are doing very, very kind of a smart job here, that they're not creators, but they're enablers of this technology. Okay, so information processing. So this is the, by far, this is the largest difference between the digital and conventional banks in the world. Because as we've seen from the previous example, they use simply different kinds of information, right? So in order for a bank to assess a loan application, you simply need to look at the balance sheet and the income statement, all the financial statements in general, and then make some sort of assessment of what's the level of the creditworthiness of the customer. For the fintechs, it operates in a slightly different way because they have an access to a huge amounts of data, and this data has value. So as I told you, I started today's lecture by showing you the evidence that shows, that looks at the very, very simple digital footprint of the customers, right? Whether you're using Android or Apple, whether you're using the hotmail.com email address or any other, how this affects the probability of you failing on your payments. So they're using pretty much the same. So ability to recognize the patterns instantly is something that has been heavily used. So Amazon, for instance, they have this credit service. So they make this decision whether to give out the loan or not in 15 seconds. All right, so you can fill in the loan application and in 15 seconds, you have to respond. In 15 seconds, it analyzes a huge amount of data, looking at your transactions on Amazon, looking at your purchases, what kind of, there is actually a paper on that. I'm not exactly sure, was it Amazon or maybe it was the Chinese, what is the Chinese alternative for Amazon? It was Alibaba, yeah, Alibaba customers. So they look whether you're making purchase during the day or during the night. And then they argue that if you're a night shopper, well, probably you're not doing it right or something like that. I'm not exactly sure, but I don't think I have it on the slides, but it's easy to find. You can Google the paper, you will find it. So it's a day or night purchases. There are other papers, and I have them on the slides, so we'll talk to them a little bit later. So what kind of other information people are using in order to assess whether the customer is good or not. And it's a soft kind of information which often grows into, this is for the traditional. So traditional banks, they can access this soft type of information when they build this relationship with the customers. But these guys, they don't have to have an access to the soft information. So they don't need to know what kind of personality you are, how do you do your business. It's enough for them to analyze the big data, big amount of data that they have, right? So there is no relationship lending in terms of the Amazon or any other big tech. But sometimes the soft data actually cannot be replaced by the hard data, the big data. So for instance, the small and medium sector, the lending in the sector is still there's a huge level of, huge degree of capacity. Okay, so a lot of information is not really available, easily available. So the only way to get it is together through some sort of a soft information, right? Through some sort of a relationship, right? So that would be the only way. Okay, let's go on for a few more slides. So yeah, we still have like roughly half an hour, a bit less. So so the issues, these are the issues that digital banks need to solve with respect to this information process, and in order to become, in order to be called like a traditional bank, or in order to be called a conventional bank, okay? So for instance, the information processing is always linked to the legal and social implications, right? So everybody starts to complain, hey, Google is watching us, we don't like that. So for Google itself, I mean, one, as long as they keep it quiet and analyze this data quietly, it's not a problem. But as long as it starts to become public that they're using particular type of information from their customers, it becomes a problem, right? So people tend to complain a lot for the usage of the private data. So they don't want to be watched when and what kind of web pages they're browsing. Some people take in the cameras in their laptop, so they think that they're being watched or something. So it's probably it could be the case. I mean, but I'm not sure how this type of information can be used for the credit assessment of you as a customer. So I'm not exactly sure how useful it is, but it's possible, right? So that's why there are a lot of, I mean, GDPR, from the research perspective, and I consider myself as a researcher. So GDPR is the worst thing that could ever happen, because it simply means that you cannot access any type of the data right now. Okay, this is the GDPR. So you know what's the GDPR, right? So this is the Data Protection Act, which was accepted in the EU as of one time ago. Was it 2019? Anyway, 2 years back. And I mean, I see the reasons for this loans to go through, laws to go through, because, for example, in Sweden, and in Finland as well, to some extent, all the tax reports, they're public information, right? So you can go to the tax office in Finland and ask who makes what, right? So it's not a problem. Everybody at the tax office would be happy to give you all the information that they have. So this particular person made this much last year, this fraction comes from the salary, and this fraction comes from the interest income. Right. So in Sweden, it's the same case, but it's more detailed in a sense. They have to fill in more detailed tax forms when it comes to their individual investments. Okay. So when they invest somewhere, it actually also show in the tax reports what kind of funds they invest and so on and so forth. Or you can get an access through the tax offices. So we used to have a project with Avanza. Avanza Bank is one of the largest providers of the private investments. Okay, so it's a bank for retail traders, basically. So it's the largest, one of the largest. It's basically like a Nordnet, but it operates only in Sweden, and Swedes like their homegrown stuff. So we used to have a project with them where we had an access to all of their customer base. So we knew how old the person is, where he or she lives, whether it's Stockholm or other part of Sweden. We knew the age, we knew the gender, we knew the transactions, of course, we knew the turnovers, we knew the portfolio values, okay? And that was before GDPR. So after GDPR, well, guess what happened? So we still know the gender, we still know the age, we still know the turnover in different instruments like stocks, bonds, and mutual funds or ETFs. But then portfolio value cannot be accessed right now because of the GDPR. Because apparently, if you have an access to the person's location, like within the country, and then you know the portfolio value of this company, you can potentially identify who the person is by accessing the the tax records.
Okay.
So we cannot have portfolio value. And you can guess that portfolio value is a very important variable in any type of the research that you do in the retail investors, right? Because how else you would control for investor size? So it's a problem. But I mean, I understand people concerned about the privacy, people concerned about the data protection, right? So that's why for these companies, for the big techs especially, it's a big problem as well. And they have to solve this in order to continue using it. I'll put it this way. So cybersecurity risk is also huge, right? So every now and then there is a big story coming in the news that this amount of data was leaked. I mean, it was also in Finland not that long time ago when some sort of the private information leaked to the general public. And then it was a big fuss about it, right? So it's still, and how does it leak? Well, probably either because of the cybersecurity flaws, or then somebody was doing it on purpose. I don't know. So there is still a big issue. And I mean, if somebody finds your phone and able to open it somehow, they probably will get a lot of, information about you by just accessing your mobile phone, because you probably keep a lot of sensitive information there as well, right? So identity thefts or any other financial scams might be easily arranged if somebody gets an access to your mobile phone. So watch out for your mobile. Not in this classroom. You're in insurance bank sales. Anyway, so another thing is that they need to learn how to transform the soft information that they get about the customers into the hard data. So they need to have the tools and the processes, technologies in order to transform, in order to quantify, in order to make this data machine readable. So there are extremely promising applications, some of the machine learning technologies or the natural language recognition and interpretation as well. This part, the textual analysis and sentiment analysis, was extremely hot, let's say 5 years ago. So 2018, it was extremely hot topic. 17, 18, it was super hot. Everybody was doing textual analysis because it was so promising. Now it seems like it's going down, but still, I don't know, technology is still developing. So that's why it's still kind of sentiment and textual analysis. So one of the papers looks at the sentiments of the Twitter posts. So they're looking at they were downloading a bunch of tweets based on some sort of hashtags or something, I'm not sure exactly. And then they were analyzing the sentiment of these tweets. And by using the sentiment, so you know what the sentiment is. So it's like either a positive or negative statement about something or neutral. And then by using the sentiment, they were able to make some sort of conclusion whether the market, stock market, will go up or down. Pretty cool, right? So it's a textual analysis. Very nice. Not sure where exactly this project ended up with, but there was a case. What else? So yeah, so preferences, desires, and attitudes recognition from social networks posts. This is also another very promising. So if somebody can analyze all the social network posts and to find it to be useful somehow, this is all the kind of related to this. And then also, and this is probably the most important part, is that what exactly are the incentives for displayers to collect and to process this information. So banks, they collect this, the traditional banks, they collect this data as delegated monitors. So they have to collect your financial statements, they have to collect some other information, they have to know how you're going to be using the money, right, when they make out the loan, simply because they act on behalf of their stakeholders. And by stakeholders, I mean not only the shareholders of the bank, but also the depositors, also the, in general, society can be considered as the stakeholder of the bank because they're interested in financial stability, they're interested in the well-functioning financial system. So that's why it's kind of, they act on behalf of them. So they screen and then they evaluate potential borrowers, they monitor performance and they manage the risk. In case of the fintechs, well, they actually have no incentive to manage the risk, right? So why would they manage the risk? So they simply have they collect the information, they analyze it, and then they redistribute it. So they have the kind of, it's the same problem as with mortgage-based securities. So they take, they give out a lot of mortgages. It's not probably a good way to say it, but in any case, it's they give out a lot of mortgages, then they bundle them together and then they sell it to the market. Same happens here. So the fintechs, they have an originate to distribute function rather than originate to keep function. Okay. So the bottom line here. So technological advances, of course, they help. They enhance the competition in financial markets. And we know that competition is most of the time it's good, right? It makes the market more efficient. It keeps the wheels running, spilling. They reduce the cost, so they make it cheaper. For you and me, the regular customers, it's good because it's cheap. It's cheaper, right? It's more efficient. They simplify a lot of financial services. So for example, when you think about investments, retail investment, it's super easy right now. It's super simple to start trading stocks and bonds right now. Well, if you think even back 10 years back, I don't think that majority of people were thinking whether he or she should start buying or selling stocks, right? Because it was kind of a complicated process. And in general, it was complicated kind of activity. But now because of this index, they make it look so simple that anyone can start doing that. And then of course they have an access to a very, very wide group of customers, wide group of users, especially when we're talking about the big techs. So the customers of the Google, huge. Customers of Apple, huge. So it's easier for them to start implementing certain things. In most cases, fintechs provide a more efficient way, but to do pretty much the same old thing. So they're doing it efficiently, but there is nothing new under the sky. So, but then again, I mean, remember that banks are not isolated, right? So they can see, they can observe, they can adopt any technology that they think it would be reasonable, viable for their service. So that's why nothing stops the banks to adopt the same type of technologies. Okay, the bottom line here is that most of fully digital so-called new banks are still very young. So roughly six, eight years now, maybe. And they still offer their services in an unbundled way. And they're often restricted in one way or another. How flexible this business model? Well, yet to be found out. Once these services are bundled together by these new banks, by the fintechs, and then all the restrictions are lifted, then there will be a huge change in the how, first of all, how the information will be processed and what kind of information will be processed. The incentives of this processing of the information. So that could significantly affect the architecture of the financial system. And again, we don't know the outcomes of this yet. So we don't know, I mean, it's hard to say whether it's going to be good or bad from the financial from the policy, you know, from the prudential point of view. And then existing traditional banks are also very, very active in adopting all these technological innovations and building their own ecosystem. So a lot of banks want, you remember the video that we saw? So that would be probably a dream case for any bank right now, that everything that people do on their daily life would be linked to a particular financial institution, starting from the daily checking of the savings account, ending up with buying flight tickets or reserving the accommodation. Okay, so this kind of ecosystem are very, very popular today. Sooner or later, the whole sector will be completely digital. That's not a big brainer. Well, I mean, at least to some extent, we will not need to do anything offline. But let's see. Yeah, so this is what we observe now. So remember this Monzo Bank. So the new bank that I showed you first as an example of the new bank. So it's extremely popular. UK digital bank, it's reported annual after-tax loss of 113, almost 14 million British pounds. And that was actually more than double the year before. Okay, so I think that was for, these numbers are for financial year 2020. So during the COVID, it actually had to lay off 120 employees in order to survive. So they explained it, this layoff as, you know, a necessity. And then this was their kind of financial statement at that time, just before the COVID. I think their financial year ended in February or March, I don't remember exactly. So financial year is not equal to the calendar year in their case. So they had a huge increase in revenues. They had the 2.3 million new customers. They had a gross lending increase, a huge increase in gross lending, almost 10 times. And then they have, I have no idea what's the net promoter score, but in any case, probably nothing. And then they have a small decline in common equity, but this is because they had at very high levels of the common equity. So the capital ratio was 104%, and they went down to 70%. And I think the regulatory minimum in the UK, I might be wrong, but I think it's something about 8%. So they're well above the margins. So let's see. This is what we observe right now. So this is the financial statement, well, a snapshot of the financial statement here. So this is year ended, yeah, so this is February 2020, 2019 and 2018. Let's see. So we have net interest income, huge increase. Okay, so money that they're charging as the interest, huge increase. Net fees and commissions, huge increase. Other operating income, well, it's the same about. And then there is expected credit losses. And it seems like it's also huge increase. Okay, so expected credit losses is something that, well, it's basically the loans that the bank gave out, but they're not expecting that they're going to be repaid. Okay, so they're writing it off as their expense. Okay, expected credit losses are right here. And then there is a huge increase in net operating income. And then this is the, this is the income statement and this is the balance sheet. Okay, so again, a short version of both of them. So the cash and balances, so this is the actual money that the bank has. So you can see that it went up from 96 million to roughly 1.3 billion. Okay. Is it comfortable to sit on this pile of cash? I don't know. Then they have the loans and advances to the customers. You can see that there is a huge increase. Yes, there is 123 million of the loans that were made in 2010 by 2020. But then if you look at the expected credit loss, which is another 20 million, so that makes it roughly, well, on about-ish, 20%. So expected credit losses to gross total loans is 20%. So I can tell you for a comparison number, in the conventional traditional bank, if you look at, for instance, at the Nordea books, it would be less than, it's probably going to be less than 1.5%. Okay. And this is 20% here. And this is, you have to remember that this is a fully licensed bank. So they position themselves as any other bank, but they just provide services in a digital way. We talked about the cash. Is it comfortable to sit on the cash? So it's only 10% of deposits. So we have here the customer's deposits is right here. So only 10%, about-ish, 10% are transformed into loans. The rest, they just keep as cash. So they take the money in form of the deposits, and they just sit on this money. Probably comfortable. So if you read the financial statement carefully, there is a very small footnote somewhere at the end, which says that the actual loans from this 120, where is that? So from 123 million, the actual loans were only 68 million, while all the other parts were simply the overdrafts. Overdrafts is when you exceed the limit for your credit card. Okay, so those are for the debit card. So this is the overdraft. So the actual loans that they purposefully give out to people was only 68 million, so roughly half of it. So the question here, when does the bank stop being a bank? And then can we consider a financial institution with the balance sheet and income statement like this to be a proper financial intermediary? Can digital banks withstand these exogenous shocks without shredding their intermediation function? And we already had the, well, if there is anything good about the COVID is that we got a lot of, you know, observations that we can analyze how certain things affect financial sector. So that's what we are dealing with. We're trying to figure out whether these guys can actually survive and whether they can still be performing the same financial intermediation function as they claim they do. Okay. So let's see. This is the part of the, this is the topic of the next part of the lecture.
Yeah,
sure. Yeah, great question. So in general, when you give out the loan, let's imagine that you're a proper bank and you're giving out the loan, you want to make sure that you get the money back, right? So at least to some extent, you probably can put aside, let's say 5-10% of the loan amount as the potential kind of loan losses. But then still, I mean, the majority you would like to get back. So you try to make sure that you do the right assessment. And they probably, I mean, this bank is probably not an exception from this. So they probably follow the same strategy, the same model. But the problem is that it's only roughly one half of their lending portfolio are real loans. And the rest are simply the credit card overdrafts. Okay? So when people overdraft on their credit card, or debit card, doesn't matter. It means that they are, well, kind of in trouble, right? Because you, in general, you want to make sure that you have enough money on your bank account to cover your daily transactions, right? But if you overdraft your account, and if you're doing it for a long period of time, it's a good indicator that something is not working as it should. So most likely, those people who overdrafted on their credit cards were doing it on purpose because they could free money. Hey, let's take it. So that's why they decided to write it off. So that was simply a flaw in the system, how this bank was attracting the new customers. They're offering the credit cards to anybody. Hey, why not to go and get it? And then they didn't realize that people could exploit this you know, this feature in order to take the to overdraft on their credit card. I'm speculating here. I don't know the exact reasons, but this is my guess. By looking at the numbers, this would be my best explanation. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. Would that be a good point to wrap up for today? Do you feel like still going? So we started at 1:35, so it's 1:40. We could go for another 5-10 minutes, but I don't think it makes sense. Let's save it for tomorrow. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much for today. See you tomorrow.